Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. Today I'm flying solo. Tony's computer has gone kaput. You know, that happens a lot with this podcast business. So much stuff goes on the laptop, but it's just another reason we need a few bobs. So stick your hand in your pocket and donate a few quid to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Become a Patreon. We have our Sunday show coming up on Sunday, which will be great. Last week's was really a live show, and with some great guests on it. Without further ado, I am joined by former Rise TD, Paul Murphy. Hiya, Paul. How are you?
Hey, Martin. I'm good.
Now, I said former Rise TD because you're no longer a Rise TD. Tell us what's going on there, Paul.
Yes. So I am now a People Before Profit TD. Rise has joined People Before Profit. The left is coming together to try to, on the one hand, provide the best possible opposition to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the capitalist system that they represent. On the other hand, to represent workers as well as we possibly can, as I think we have done throughout the pandemic in terms of Debenhams, taxi drivers, artists, lots of other groups of workers, student nurses, and then also to place a real emphasis on the need for eco-socialist change to try to avoid the climate catastrophe that we're currently hurtling towards.
And that's a good point to kick off. There is a space there for an eco-socialist movement. Everybody sees it. Are you trying to occupy that space by moving with People Before Profit?
Yeah, I mean, I think when Rise was founded, I suppose there was two things that we placed a big emphasis on. One was the need for a broad party of the left with space for people coming from different traditions and tendencies to be in one party to fight together while continuing to have their debates. And the other was that the left needs to define itself as eco-socialist. And that's just like a symbol of saying we recognize that like a central crisis, like probably the central crisis facing humanity, is the climate crisis. We also have the biodiversity crisis, which is experienced in this country and right around the world, and really emphasizing that, like, you know, as the placards of many of the school students say, we need system change, not climate change. And that system change has to be a system which doesn't prioritize profit, which is at the essence of what capitalism is. So yeah, I mean, and part of what us joining People Before Profit has adopted a new tagline, which I'm not sure has gone online anywhere yet, so this might be an exclusive.
Go on.
So it's People Before Profit and then fighting for workers and eco-socialism. So bringing really eco-socialism to the
okay fore. And there's a lot of, how do we put this, disaffected Greens out there who have left the Green Party. Are you looking to put down a landing strip for them?
Yes. I mean, those people who are hopefully drawn the conclusion that, look, kind of establishment, capitalist, green politics, supposedly the politics of we're not left, we're not right, has demonstrably failed, you know, for the second time in what, just over a decade, has resulted in the Greens being involved in, you know, horrendous right-wing government and really damaging the name of environmentalism. So hopefully that people have drawn the conclusions that you should not go into coalition ever with the establishment parties, and that it's always going to be a disaster. Instead, you have to fight for a left and eco-socialist government. Though the people have drawn those conclusions and like agree, and I presume they do, with like the focus of People Before Profit and the socialist left on people power as the way to win change. Like you see the movement at the moment against CETA, which is, you know, a movement from below, even in the context of the pandemic, forced them to delay the vote and, you know, has forced them onto the back foot a little bit. People Before Profit, I would really encourage people, go and join People Before Profit. People Before Profit can be a home for you.
Before Profit did some great work in the last administration on environmental issues. I think it was the Keep It In The Ground Bill was one big win that People Before Profit had. A lot of work went into that. Does that establish their green credentials? Does that give them, you know, the footing to say we are the socialist Green Party?
I think partly the left socialist left, radical left, whatever, the far, far left.
We'll get into that Zoom in a few minutes.
Zoom meeting was titled. whatever you want to call us. I think a humility is required on our behalf to say that, while the Green Party was making loads of mistakes over the past decades, they did focus on the environment, and the left was not always there. That's the truth. And there is what we'd call kind of a productivist strain within the left, which just sees producing more stuff as the thing, which we think you can go back to Marx and Marx's analysis of the rift between humanity and nature. Now, that isn't actually what Marxism is about. That's like a distortion by Stalinism. But I think there has been a problem on the left, including non-Stalinist parts of the left. But I think that, Breed in particular, but also all of People for Profit did excellent work in the last all. There is agreement in terms of analysis. There's agreement in terms of the need to call ourselves eco-socialists and to have an eco-socialist frame. So I think while having humility about mistakes that were made in the past, I think, we should call out. We want more people who have more expertise, more experience in the environmental movement to get involved in the left and to help make it, even more conscious and even more active on these issues.
Okay, let's get into this left, right, far, far left, far, far, far left bit, Paul. Where are you on the spectrum, Paul? And tell us what left is, tell us what far left is, and tell us what's the difference between the two.
Who knows? I mean, everyone has their own definitions, right? And obviously, we will use certain terms to define ourselves, okay? So that, the kind of terms that I would favor using, socialist left, I think that clarifies that, or eco-socialist left actually is what I would really emphasize. I'd also say revolutionary left, because certainly stand for a revolution in terms of the way society is organized and overthrow of the capitalist system. And I also recognize that people do call us far left. Mostly when they call us far left, they're intending to diminish us or
cast aspersions, as we say down this way. Yeah, I don't get that.
That's what they're doing. But okay, if people call us far left, people call us far left. It's not, for us, it's the content of what you stand for. So we're not going to define ourselves in those terms. But obviously, when Drew Harris uses the term far left, people do think of us, and not unreasonably, because the media uses the term for us. So you had this, I'm sure you saw the bizarre, Twitter is a bizarre place, but one of the most bizarre kind of galaxy brain stuff that I've seen from Conor Lally of the Irish Times.
I saw it myself. So the fact that you're elected takes you from being far left to just being left. So on that measure, you're a left TD.
Exactly. So that's what he's saying. Once you get elected, you're no longer far left. So therefore, why are you bothered about Drew Harris saying these things? But I was able to respond with an Irish Times article, which had a picture of me from Matt Leahy talking about the aftermath of Jobstown in the headline had far left, because we are called in these terms. But also the idea that just by being somewhat successful in electoral terms, you're no longer far anything. So the example I gave, obviously Hitler was elected. He was far right. Do you know what I mean? He was horrendously far right. I mean, nobody disputes that. But with Conor Lally's logic, so it didn't make any sense. But it was an attempt to kind of cover for the significance of what Drew Harris said, which was, without any basis in fact whatsoever, creating an equivalence between far left and far right in terms of the violence that we saw at that far right demonstration last Saturday. And then that's used predictably. I'm not sure if you saw Ben Gilroy's tweet claiming that Drew Harris said, "I personally am connected to the guy who fired the rocket at the Gardaí," which is obviously complete nonsense, as in I'm not connected, and also complete nonsense, as in fairness, in terms of what Drew Harris said, he didn't say that either. But it's exactly what would be expected, as the far right would use that to muddy the waters.
Yeah, we saw that tactic in the States after they stormed the Capitol, that the blame was put on the far left straight away as... I suppose agent provocateurs somewhere in the crowd pushing this forward. Did it surprise you that that was thrown out in the current state of Irish politics, that when you see a far right march that gets violent, the immediate reaction is to say, well, the far left's in there somewhere?
It did, I suppose. I mean, maybe I'm a bit naive, but for anyone who's on the left and who's watching the right and is concerned about the potential rise of the right, we knew that a protest was happening, anti-lockdown. We knew it was had the far right at its core, tapping into broader frustrations about lockdown and stuff, but it has the far right at its core. And then when the violence happens, then the idea that the Garda commissioner comes out and says elements of the far left and far right. And even, I mean, he was forced to back down because there's obviously no evidence for it. But even in his retraction, he said, despite initial indications, it turns out there's no far left elements. But I'd love to know, what were these initial indications? Did you have people selling socialist newspapers and magazines? Did you have placards from the left? Were there public representatives of the left there? Like, I'm sure none of those things happened. So, like, I don't believe that there were any initial indications. I think for some reason he decided to just say, you know, this is all, it's kind of the mob. It's like, and they're all the same kind of horseshoe theory, far right, far left.
I thought it was a very interesting view on his part that, you know, I thought he was trying to balance things. And mm-hmm. coming from the north of Ireland, you know, they do try and balance when they're putting out statements. There's always a both sides to it. But that doesn't necessarily transfer down here in that, you know, the far left, which we will, I'm going to say, let's call you far left, Paul. The far
only
left.
One far?
One far. No, there is a far further out than you, I would say, too. But, you know, in left, in Irish politics, you are of the far left. You believe in the end of capitalism. You believe in a new way of doing things. You'd like to see the system that exists at the moment totally gone. I'm right about that, am I?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we don't hide that. That's the thing.
No, you don't hide it. And I mean, let's face it, neoliberalism isn't actually doing a whole lot for the COVID situation. The more neoliberal your country, the worse your response. And people before profit were very quickly onto the zero COVID. You've been zero COVID since first lockdown, as far as I can remember. I don't think you were calling it zero COVID. You were just saying stamp it out. And when they were saying flatten the curve,
first time we used the term zero COVID would have been in October, I think, which is still like well in advance. But in essence, the key parts of that strategy we were advocating from the start. And I think there is, so it's a factor in terms of us joining People for Profit, because like the discussions between Rise and People for Profit, there were discussions, but there's also common work. And the fact that we both had the same approach, broadly speaking, we were both out very early, relatively speaking, on zero COVID, brought us closer. And it demonstrated that we have an approach that the left needs to try to bring, you know, answers to the immediate crises facing people. And those answers should be informed by a logic which says public health, people's needs should come before profit. And that's like, from my point of view, an inherently anti-capitalist socialist logic. And for example, we would have put up an article about, you know, zero COVID Ireland with socialist policies, talking about the need to nationalize the private health industry, bring it into the public health system, support people, have workers committees in meat factories and so on to, you know, oversee, ensure that there's safety. So that was a very big positive for us, is that the fact that us and People for Profit of the left were on the same wavelength on, okay, like, Here's a strategy which can work, which is informed by science. And I also think there's a parallel in terms of climate change, you know, because the same people who want us to do the impossible of live with COVID, they're also going to want us to live with climate change, as opposed to following the science, even though it goes against short-term profit interests in terms of COVID or in terms of avoiding climate catastrophe.
Yeah, it's a bit like, let me ask you, does what is Rise, and does it still exist as an entity? Is it still there? But it's not a political party anymore because there's no TDs involved in it. So what exactly is it?
Yeah, so Rise is now a network within People Before Profit. So like, you know, the vast majority of the work that we do will be People Before Profit. I will be on your podcast and RTE and all the other illustrious shows that I get on as a People Before Profit TD. But we will, as Rise, continue, for example, to produce our excellent podcast, Rupture Radio. We'll continue to produce our eco-socialist quarterly magazine, Rupture. And, you know, we'll have a website and we'll be making arguments that are primarily arguments aimed at those who are, you know, existing activists on the left, about strategy, about theory, about how the left should approach different questions, how can we build the most effective left, things like that. And that's kind of, It's part of our model for like how a broad, successful party of the left can be built, is that we think you have to recognize that there's going to be different trends of opinion, and you have to allow people to organize on the basis of those and to debate things out in like a calm, fraternal, democratic way. And so far, experience in People for Profit, I don't just mean the last 2 days. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, we've been attending meetings for the last while, is of, you know, that sort of place where lively democratic debate, where people disagree, people debate, people vote, and then you move on, you don't fall out with people. And, you know, it's very positive.
Okay. So is it fair to say that there's an effort at some consolidation on the left to bring the more diverse elements together into a voting block, even a speaking block within the Dáil? Is that the rationale behind it?
Well, I'd say People for Profit is definitely more than that. So I think Solidarity People for Profit is that, and Solidarity People for Profit as a, you know, as a block with parliamentary speaking rights and all that in the Dáil will continue, and will continue for elections, and hopefully will be continue to be relatively successful, and hopefully more successful as we go on. But People for Profit and us joining People for Profit is more than that, in the sense that it is an attempt to actually form, you know, a broad eco-socialist party. There's currently, I think, about 3,000 members of People for Profit. I think there are thousands of people out there who broadly agree with the politics of People for Profit, who, you know, we're appealing to get involved, join, make it your party, you know, get involved in the campaigns you want to be involved in, and to try and build, you know, a very substantial party of the radical left, or whatever you want to call it, over the next, you know, year and years, because like COVID is going to reshape politics around the world and in Ireland. And I think that it certainly is going to provide an opening for the reshaping of politics to the left, because, neoliberalism.
I'd kind of disagree with you there. If you look across Europe, you look at Hungary, you look at Poland, you look at France, you look at Italy, it's actually reshaping politics for the right, not for the left.
I think it's both. I think there's a deep polarization going on. So I think the establishment has been further undermined by COVID and their reactions to COVID. And there's a lot of frustration out there. And where the right is well positioned, you're absolutely correct that it's been able to make advances. But the same also applies, I think, in terms of the potential for the left. And I think like we have a danger here in Ireland of the rise of the right, no question about it. But I think there are some features of COVID which lend themselves to a left-wing analysis. For example, one, the failure of the kind of neoliberalized state to deal with COVID. Two, the failure of kind of short-term profit thinking, and the fact that that led in Ireland, you know, from the decisions in November, December, to like 2,000 deaths in January and February. Three, the fact that like the importance of workers, and actually it's the fact that workers make the world go round, has, I think, been demonstrated quite clearly in terms of your shop workers, your nurses, your cleaners. Do you know what I mean? Rather than the people who are getting rich off of COVID.
But I think it has been demonstrated that workers are that what we call essential workers were, for the main part, low paid workers, mm-hmm. up to this point. But yep. What we're seeing is that the entrenchment of government on wages, on paying people, there's no shift. In fact, they're more entrenched than they were before COVID about paying people for the work that they do, paying them properly for the work that they do.
Definitely. I mean, they're going to resist these things, no question about it. The question is whether after COVID lifts, whenever you've, you know, hopefully, let's say by the end of this year, you have widespread vaccination, etc. Well, what are people going to do? You know, are people just going to accept that everything stays, you know, everything goes back to the way it was, and
back to this phrase, back to normal.
Yeah, that the eviction ban is gone and the Dole is back to 200 euros. And you know what I mean? That workers aren't valued as they weren't in reality through COVID. Or will you have an explosion of issues, movements post-COVID, for example, on housing or on climate change, of people demanding, you know, like I think a parallel, I'm not saying it will be exactly the same, but like after World War II, soldiers came back home and were like, wait a minute, we were meant to be fighting for democracy against fascism, but we don't have the right to housing. We don't have any of these things. And like health, there was a swing left, you know?
Yeah, well, there is also part of that too, that there were hundreds of thousands of demobbed men who knew how to organize and use weapons. So it was either build houses and a public health service or deal with those angry men. I mean, that was the real driving force, particularly in the UK, mm-hmm. with their public health service and their social services that exist. And even though they've been decimated, some of them are still way better than what we have here.
Yeah.
Working with other parties, Paul, and you've said it, and you said it at the beginning that, you know, the mistake is to go into coalition with, we'll say, the two mains, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. But the way politics stacks up in Ireland, you're going to get into government, you have to be in coalition with either Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, or increasingly Sinn Féin. That's how it looks. Where do you stand on coalition with the three of them?
At once?
No, we won't say at once.
That'd be a nice word. I'm only messing. We're against coalition with Fianna Fáil. We're against coalition with Fine Gael. And whether we would enter a coalition with Sinn Féin, excluding Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, would depend on what is in the programme for government. And effectively, People Before Profit will enter the next election, you know, very strongly, very loudly calling for a left government, so a government excluding Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but also setting out key red lines to ensure that we don't have a left government that actually disappoints people, that doesn't meet people's aspirations. So those, the sort of red lines that we'd be talking about would be, you know, a commitment to 10% carbon reduction year on year, based on, you know, a series of measures, but including saying, look, we need to take the big polluters into public ownership, based on saying we need a banking system that's in public ownership, based on saying we need to refuse to pay the debt that's not our debt. So a series of radical demands. And if they were agreed, well then, and we're going to have a government that is actually committed to opening the door to break with the capitalist system and create an alternative society, we could be part of such a government. If they weren't agreed, well then we would, like we did after this election, vote for the Sinn Féin candidate for Taoiseach. And to the extent that they do stuff in line with the interests of ordinary people, we would vote for those things. But we'd also send a warning that if you don't fulfill on your promises, well, then we'll be organizing demonstrations to build housing, to build a national health service against you too. So kind of holding their feet to the fire and basing on mobilization.
Okay, there's some big asks in that, Paul, particularly on the finance. There's big asks to say that the debt that was, and I agree with you, it was a debt that was foisted on us, that we would walk away from that debt and say, no, it's nothing to do with us. Now, personally, I feel it's nothing to do with us. But as a nation, it's a different story. We have assumed that debt, for better or for worse. How does it help us to walk away from that? You know, that affects our credit rating, that affects our ability to borrow. I mean, that's a big ask to ask anybody to turn their back on. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, you see, I think we have to learn the lessons of Syriza, you know. I was very involved in, I mean, relatively involved for an Irish person in Greek politics. You know, I went to Greece a whole bunch of times over a few years. And the Greek people had their hopes invested in Syriza. And Syriza betrayed those hopes and set back the left. And to be honest, what happened wasn't that people then turned further left. Most people became demoralized. New Democracy was then re-elected, the kind of center-right party again. And the reason for that failure was fundamentally because Syriza was committed to playing within the rules of European capitalism.
Yeah, well, the goal was put to their head and mm-hmm. they were told, play ball or there's no money. Isn't that basically what
exactly
happened?
And that's the thing. They use banks rather than tanks. The European Central Bank throttled the Greek banking system and said, unless you agree to this austerity. And then people came out and they voted, you know, in 60-something percent, Ohi, saying no to this austerity, despite the gun that was to their head, even though the Syriza leadership really wanted them to vote yes, even though they were forced to campaign for a no. There was a deep hypocrisy happening there. But then nonetheless, after that, you know, Tsipras sold it all out. And so, we're not going to be part of a government that is going to do that. And that means a left government, if it's going to be successful, is going to be have to say to the EU, we're not going to obey your fiscal rules, which says, for example, we can't use windfalls to build public housing. We don't accept that. We're not going to accept that odious debt that was built up by paying off, you know, bondholders' debts, that we're not going to accept that that's our debt. We're not going to accept that Ireland has to continue as a corporate tax haven, that's the only developmental model for Ireland. And so, yes, they are a series of radical demands, no question about it. But I think we'll find that if a government isn't committed to doing, you know, most of those things or essentially those things, they won't manage to deliver on the expectations. And I think people now have you know, high expectations of what society could be. All the wealth is created in this country by ordinary people. You know what I mean? The fact that we could be a leader in terms of green energy, etc.
We'll take the deficit for just for a moment and the rules around having deficits. I mean, Spain were a little more subtle than to say, you know, we're not obeying your rules. They just said, we're not paying your fines, and they sent it back, and the EU did nothing. Is there more of a room to be more subtle about it, Paul, rather than in-your-face confrontational? No, we're not going to pay this. Now, sod off and take your debt with you.
I mean, there's two kind of levels of analysis. One thing is like for yourselves to know what you're doing, right? And I think if you're going to have a left-wing government and it's going to be successful, you have to know that you're not going to be accepting the rules of capitalism. You're going to put people's needs first and follow the logic of that. A secondary question is like the exact tactics of that. You know what I mean? I was in favor. If I was in the Syriza government, I would have been in favor of sitting down with the EU and negotiating with them. No question. You use the negotiations to try and appeal to ordinary people across Europe to see your side of the argument. You know what I mean? You use them to try and speak over the heads of Angela Merkel to the German workers, to the Irish workers, say, it's our interest together against the interests of the banks and the bondholders. So like you absolutely would have to, you know, engage in negotiations and things like that. But the question is of a mindset, you know? So it's like our podcast and our magazine, they're called Rupture for a reason. And it's like a ruptural kind of framework of understanding you need a rupture from the way that society is currently organized. You need a fundamental break from the society that's currently organized. And if we're going to have a government that's going to deliver on the change that people want, the government needs to be committed to that kind of strategy. And within that strategy, there'll be this and that tactic and so on, absolutely. But like, if you don't have that framework of like, this is the way we look at it, you're going to find yourself in trouble.
Theoretically, the numbers exist on the left to make a left coalition. Now, I'm excluding Fianna Fáil, I'm excluding Fine Gael, and I'm excluding the Greens from that. Theoretically, the numbers exist. Do you think the tyranny of small differences will keep the left disorganized as a grouping?
Well, I think the main thing, to be honest, the main thing that will stop this happening, and it may or may not happen, you know, but I think the main danger is the likes of Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats looking to their right as opposed to looking to their left, looking to do a coalition with Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. And so there's two ways that affects it. One is actually post an election situation. I fear, and there's a lot of talk from Sinn Féin these days that, well, we could do a deal with Fianna Fáil in particular, more so than Fine Gael, you know? And I fear that they'll look at that and say, that's a more stable option, you know, than relying on external support from PPP or whatever. But the second thing is that, like, to the extent to which they continually send out the message that they're open to do deals after an election, that undermines the momentum. Like, I think if Sinn Féin came out tomorrow and said, you know, we think there's a chance for fundamental change in Irish politics to break the stranglehold of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and as part of that, we're making a commitment now. We're not going into coalition with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. We want to lead, you know, an alternative government of the rest. I think that would create its own dynamic and people would think, wow, you know, there's some substantial change is actually on offer here. I'm going to go to that rally. I'm going to get involved. I'm going to really push for that. Because politics isn't like, it's not a done deal. You know what I mean? The vast majority of people have not decided how they're going to vote in the next election. Things will happen between now and then. And you could create a real dynamic around that idea. And because it kind of took off, you know, in the course of the last election.
It did, organically. Yes, it did. Yeah, it did. Well, you know, I have a view that maybe Sinn Féin are more pragmatic about governance. They describe themselves as a party of government, which is, you know, if you've been pragmatic about it, you got to be in government to make a change. And you have to be in government to make a change. It's very hard to make it from the sidelines. Is there not an element of you need to be more pragmatic, that if the numbers fell a certain way, that if you could get a 70% left coalition with a 30% Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil kicker, is it not worth doing? Is it not worth taking that chance and doing it? You know, that kind of pragmatism, I can see why. I can understand why. But are you excluding yourself from that?
Because I think ultimately politics is about class representation, right? There's loads more things on top of that, but that's like at the core of what politics is. And if Fianna Fáil are in a government, they're going to represent their class. And their class, for example, it's a very simple example. They represent the landlords very well. And so, you know, such a government is going to have a choice very, very quickly. Are we going to reinstate a ban on evictions, or are we going to continue to hide behind the idea that it's unconstitutional and you can't do it? And if it is, fine, we have a referendum. Show me, and we'll win the referendum without doubt to say that we'll, it's constitutional to have evictions banned. And Fianna Fáil will not wash such an attack on the class that they represent, or a part of the class that they represent. And I think that's fundamentally why they will not, if you have a government that have Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, you know, it's not about the individuals in Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. It's about, like, they as a party and what they represent will not allow the kind of change that is necessary to actually deliver. And, like, you know, of course we're for a left eco-socialist government. But, like, this logic that says you have to be in government at all costs, it blurs the line between being in power and being in government, and, like, you know, potentially at a different level makes the same kind of mistake that, you know, you look at the Greens, like, they're in there, you know, with those kind of, oh, well, we have to be in, and this is, but, like, no, like, you know what I mean?
I mean, the Greens are an example of not having lines, of not mm-hmm. having red lines. I mean, that is an example of not having them. Do you think that People Before Profit can run enough candidates in the next election to have an impact? I mean, really and truly, if you look at the figures, and consistently People Before Profit are right up there with Labour and Social Democrats on the polls, and I don't put much store in the polls, but for a small party, they are hitting above their weight at the present moment in time. Will they be able to transfer that into seats by putting enough candidates out?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, definitely the plan is to stand people basically in every constituency across the country. Who knows when the next election will be? Who knows the context of the next election? I think it's certainly possible that the left will be under pressure from Sinn Féin, because, you know, Sinn Féin is the largest force with the biggest media presence, the biggest doll presence, the biggest kind of amount of resources and everything that is articulating, you know, a criticism of the government, broadly speaking, from, you know, an anti-establishment left kind of place. So I think we could be, you know, we'll be under pressure. But I do think that the stance we've taken on COVID, which I think, to be honest, like, stands out in sharp contrast to Sinn Féin's stance on COVID, which has been to trail the government, unfortunately, largely. And once COVID is, you know, hopefully partially behind us, and you have movements again, our orientation to people power movements will kind of tell out. You know what I mean? That was how, it was why the radical left rose on the back of and connected to the anti-water charges movement, the repeal movement. Like, when people are out and active and feeling their own power and their ability to change things, and not so much focused on just what happens in the Dáil, but more focused on changing things themselves, then people move quite radically, I think, to the left, and our kind of arguments resonate with people. So I think a lot depends on the context in which the election will take place. But I do feel that, like, the main trend in politics for loads of people, I mean, there's obviously a right-wing trend as well towards consolidation around Fine Gael, not Fianna Fáil. But the main trend that we're interested in is people looking to elect a government of change, a left government, an alternative government, whatever form people want to look at it. And in an Irish sense, I think Sinn Féin has the majority stake in that. But I actually think the electoral system means that people have a kind of sophisticated view of that. And, you know, they may like the Social Democrats, or they may like the socialist left or whatever, and kind of see them in that context as well.
When you look to Portugal and you see that they could bring a diverse left together to go into government, and I know there's going to be a little bit of argument about the second election where they got back in again, and their minority government there this time around, but they were a majority government. They kept within the fiscal rules, pretty much. They didn't rock any boats within the EU, but their ethos was to improve the lot of those who are the most marginalized in society. They don't measure it by GDP. They measure it by, you know, how are the poorest doing? Is that something you could see coming into Irish politics?
I mean, I think the basic approach that the left bloc and the Portuguese Communist Party took to the, you know, so-called Socialist Party, you know, more equivalent to a Labour Party, whatever, coming to power in Portugal, as in kind of minority government supported from the outside, and we have these red lines, and if you agree with the red lines, we agree to vote with you. I think that basic approach is is the likely situation we would be in with relative to the socialist left, its relationship to Sinn Féin after an election. I think that's the most likely situation, because I think it's unlikely that Sinn Féin would agree with the kind of red lines that we would have to go into a government. But let's see. Let's have that discussion. Let's have the pressure from below. The kind of main criticism that I would make, and it's from a distance, of the approach of the left bloc and the Portuguese Communist Party in that, and it is a danger for the eco-socialist left here too, is that despite their not officially being part of the government, despite the fact that they didn't take ministerial positions, you would have the impression that they became kind of caught up in a logic of being connected to the government, and the kind of not enough emphasis by them on let's continue to mobilize from below, let's put pressure on the government to do the stuff that they say they're going to do, not enough feeling free to criticize the government. And the result is that it seems to me from the election results that, like, in a way, the Socialist Party, the like Social Democratic Party, really kind of got credit for the stuff, the good stuff they did, rather than the left. And like, in a way, the left then got blamed for the bad stuff. And also a space was created in Portuguese politics for the first time in a long time for the emergence of a far-right force. I mean, they did very well in the presidential elections.
Well, they did about as well as Peter Casey did over here, percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. It's in the same ballpark. So if we see Peter Casey as the rise of the right, well, they've had the same kind of experience then in Portugal. I think that's fair to say.
But I think, let me Google them here now. So you had the establishment politician guy who was currently president. He's obviously personally popular and he won
very much the
thing. So he took a big vote. But they were then, the far right was third, I think.
Yeah.
After the socialist person and ahead of the two radical left. And I think, you know, there is a, I mean, there is a parallel with Ireland in the sense that Portugal, unlike Spain, hasn't historically had a strong far-right political force, just like we haven't. And I think, like, obviously Peter Casey, like a lot of these people are kind of joke figures, like, right? But, like, it is the case that, like, post-Peter Casey in Ireland, there is this, like, defined space or somewhat defined space for the emergence of a far-right. And there's a whole bunch of, like, you know, absolute, like, you know, head the ball far right people who like all hate each other or whatever, but who do recognize that there's something here for them and are trying to get in and the act in terms of organizing it. And I think, unfortunately, and I presume it's the same in Portugal, but I don't know, that like COVID has been an opportunity for them because the left isn't mobilizing on the streets, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. COVID is the opportunity, and the left can't mobilize because to stay within guidelines you can't have, but I think that's felt right across the board. Soft left, far left, far left, I think it's felt with everybody. Looking to the future, Paul, when do you reckon we're going to have an election? I mean, my feeling is as soon as people can put feet on the streets, that the election comes weeks afterwards. That's my feeling on it.
Mm-hmm.
What's your
feeling? I was chatting with Richard by power the other day about this. I said, oh yeah, I think there could be an election next year. I think that exactly, like, the two things of pressure from below, whenever COVID has lifted, and then people, and then the changeover, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Varadkar and Martin swapping, which introduces a kind of instability at the top. I think that does create a scenario whereby the thing can fall apart under pressure from below, and then the two of them looking at each other, and you know what I mean? I think that is very possible. Richard was skeptical. he thought further down the line.
I think if you look at Fianna Fáil as, you know, in the historical sense and how far it's come, how many years, that the best move they could make, considering all of their history, is to pull the plug before Varadkar gets into government. I think that would be the very best. And I think strategically for Fianna Fáil, that's a vote winner. It's the only vote winner they actually have left in the bag. They're losing votes everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a vote winner, is to pull the plug and not let Fine Gael back in. I mean, that would be a great move. Now, whether they'll do it or not, I very much doubt it. But yeah, I see an instability. The instability in the government is there. They are as factional as the left is, but they're doing it in government. They're getting paid to be ministers while they're doing it. Can the left ever get into that space, where that same headspace where, look, we can have our fights, but we can have our fights in government?
Well, to start with, we've moved to having the position where we can have our fights within a party. They're not fights, they're, you know what I mean? They're like disagreements. And mostly agreement, of course. So that's a big step forward. I do think that, look, a lot of this is like, you know, what I say, like as objective factors in the sense of politics isn't determined by like just what people like political actors do. It's primarily informed by what the attitudes of ordinary people is at different points in time. But I would make the point that like in 2008, Sinn Féin had 5 TDs, which is currently the amount of TDs the Solidarity PVP have. The crisis obviously hit and hit hard and, you know, reshaped the political landscape in Ireland. And fast forward to now, and Sinn Féin is the largest political force the last general election in percentage terms, and often in opinion polls continues to be so. And so, you know, I personally think what's most likely in the aftermath of the next election, unfortunately, and we've got to fight to make sure this doesn't happen, but I think there's a strong chance that Sinn Féin is in government with Fianna Fáil. And I think if that's the case, that'll be deeply disappointing. Maybe not immediately, because I think they'll be skillful about it. But if they go in, it will ultimately be deeply disappointing to their base. And if that's what happens, well, then that is going to open up a new political picture. And I think there's a real danger there that, like, the right, if the right is properly organized, they could be the recipients of a lot of that discontent. So therefore, I think it's vital that we have a socialist, eco-socialist left with as strong a national presence as possible to fight for a left government, like immediately, do you know what I mean? As soon as possible. But in the event that that is what happens, that is positioned there as an alternative pole that is able to explain in truthful terms, not in the kind of lies that the far right will tell, why this is taking place, why this has been this disappointment. And I think, you know, such a party at that moment, if that's the situation we're in, could be extremely well positioned to grow dramatically and then to actually have the possibility of having, you know, a majority socialist, eco-socialist left government. But we'll see. And maybe Sinn Féin can come under such pressure from below that they don't feel able to go into coalition with Fianna Fáil.
No, it's an interesting scenario. I'm kind of with you, Paul. The election isn't 4 years away. I think the introduction of austerity again following this period will be the deciding factor on what people want. We've been there. We've done that. We've worn the T-shirts. So I don't think we want to go back to it again. Paul, thank you very much for taking the time to come and have this chat with me this morning. It's always interesting to chat with the bogeyman of the far left. And I think you wear that mantle. And I think you kind of wear that mantle proudly and say, yeah, I am far left. But, you know, this is what the far left is about. So, you know, if you don't like it, what is your position? So thanks for coming on and having this chat with us about the far left, about People Before Profit. And we wish you well in your endeavors in the future.
Thank you very much, Martin, and I hope Tony's computer gets better.
Yeah, so do I. Just a little reminder to everybody, look, these podcasts cannot keep going without your support. So stick your hand in your pocket, become a patron at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you all.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.